session number 26852, Reel 1.
It's Joe Coop, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Coop?
I was born in North Devon, Barnstable Town, Barham, on July the 4th, 1932.
Could you tell us a bit about your family background?
Yes, my mother's family was the most influential part of my life, the Acklands, who were well known in Barnstable and have a long history of local government, and the town crier was always in Ackland, and the mayor was often in Ackland, and there are many trophies in the civic centre there that bear the name. But basically, my grandfather, most influential man for me.
In what way?
Well, he was a cobbler and one of those wise men. Both my grandfathers were illiterate, but they were the wisest men I knew. And I'd go down to the bottom of the garden and sit in his shed and see he had mouths full of nails and he was banging away and making his living by mending and repairing boots. And charming man. Always had a wise way of dealing with difficult problems, but he was also a man of his generation. He was hard. He served in the Boer War and probably enlisted when he was too young to. My mother was called Tugela, as a Christian name, because that was a river in Africa in which she'd been fighting when she was born, which is quite interesting. A large family, the Acklands. I think there were 13 to start with, and several died in childbirth, you know, being born.
What about the other side, your father's side?
My father was from a Lancashire family. Music was in the blood, I gather, because his father had been a conductor of the choirs, the local cotton mill choirs, I gather. But they'd moved to Bournemouth. And my grandmother was a wonderful woman, his mother. She taught me to cheat at all sorts of games, like cards. Taught me how to smoke and had a wonderful ability to swear under her breath when things went wrong. And her kitchen always smelled of bread and lovely things.
Now, what did your father do for a living?
He was a GPO engineer. My mother had been a, what do you call them? They worked with telephone systems, exchange girl. So they'd met through their work, I think, at Linton in North Devon. I think one of his great regrets was that he wasn't able to join the army during the war because he was in a trade which was considered to be too valuable.
The First War, you mean?
Second World War. Yeah. So
it was a fairly comfortable upbringing.
It was a fairly comfortable upbringing to begin with. It got more difficult as time went on because my mother didn't send me to school until I was 7, and I think she upset the local authority. She didn't like the schools. And then I ended up at we moved to Exeter when I was 7, I think. And we were blitzed out there.
Dad, you started school then? Which came first?
Schools came first.
Tell us about your education then. We'll come on to the war.
Well, the first school that I can remember was a small private nursery type school in Mount Pleasant in Exeter. I remember that they used the radio a lot to give us lessons there. It didn't last very long, and my mother took me to another place, which didn't last very long either. But I ended up at this Ladysmith Junior School in a certain part of Exeter, which was much more formal and to the point. And then I moved on to the upper school where I was caned regularly. The cane was a wonderful thing in those days. And one, you never forget the name of the schoolmaster that caned you, Elijah Lane. My God, could he lay it on.
And what were you doing wrong?
I'm never quite sure. Just being there, I think.
How did you do at school? I mean, you know.
Well, I enjoyed school enormously, but I was frequently ill and taken off from school.
What problems? What with?
Eye problems for a start, and bowel problems, apparently. No, not much evidence of it now. Then, of course, in 1939, when the war started.
Well, tell me about the outbreak of war. You'd be seven.
Yes, yes.
What do you remember? I mean,
I remember the broadcasts and sitting in a hushed way around the radio listening, because radio was the most influential thing. I think I learned a lot of my music and literature through the radio. But I remember the hushed silence at the news. It was equivalent to listening to the football polls, because the results were being read out as well. But and Churchill's speeches and the horror that went through the family when all this happened, because so many people had been, my mother's side particularly, had lost relatives during the First World War.
Now, it would be Chamberlain, but do you remember...
George Chamberlain, I remember the broadcast, yes, sorry.
I mean, what impact did it have on your family, would you say? When you heard it.
Anxiety, tension, worry. Is it going to happen all over again? The relationships changed and became very sort of nervy.
Did you understand yourself at that age what was going on?
No, no, not at all. We still continued having fun. We could play outside and do all sorts of things you can't do today. Had a bicycle which you tried to commit suicide on, and people were gone encouraging you. You could go out all day and play down by the river and nobody would worry. There's lots of friends and groups of people in that area.
Now, how did the war affect you in various ways? I mean, school first, did it affect the school?
The various schools I went to, you spent under the desk half the time when the siren went. Because that was the best air raid shelter you could provide in that school. You sat under the desk with your other friends.
What do you remember of the air raids? Let's cover that then.
Well, I lived in Exeter, and people don't remember that Exeter was severely blitzed and was a regular target in the early years of the war. And we could hear this. I saw the dogfights regularly. We'd look out, even at Bournemouth, you could look out over and see the dogfights in the sky. I remember seeing the. And in Exeter, it was the Polish squadrons that manned the Spitfires and Hurricanes that went up to take the Germans on. And we would stand in the street and watch them. I remember Exmouth on the coast had been turned into a whole concrete gun-emplaced embankment facing the sea. And quite extraordinary, I couldn't go and play in the places where I used to play because the bloody army had taken all this down there. And then the most extraordinary part was my father had been working very hard, hardly ever saw him, restoring the communications of whatever it was he was supposed to be doing. And my mother had gone, and I had gone to Barnstable to stay away from the blitzes for a while. But she had one of those premonitions, you know, and despite all the family persuasion and advice, she determined to come home that one particular weekend, which she did. And it's a good job she did, because if she hadn't, my father would have stayed in bed and gone to sleep and been killed, because the house was blitzed that night. But he had a van that he drove around, which was very rare in those days for any man of my father's generation to have a vehicle, but it was a works van. And she insisted we all got into that damn thing and drove up into the country that night, which would be May 1942, if I remember rightly. And I remember looking out over the city and watching it burn. It's one of those vivid, extraordinary pictures that remain with you forever. We slept under hedges, and we'd heard the gunfire, and we'd heard the aircraft engaging above us, and I looked out over the hedge, and you just saw this city burn. It's like a match and a candle held in the night. An extraordinary sight.
And that was the night of...
Probably May the 10th of it, 42, I think.
And so you went out to the countryside.
And then going back the following day, particularly as we came to Exbridge and went over it, the whole of the streets were snaked with hose pipes. And the smell of burning, the horror of the smoke being drawn down the north side of the street. We had to find our way to our home, and when we got there, The house had been pretty well demolished. It was a semi-detached like this. And on one side, both houses had gone, but the middle wall was still standing and the chimney was smoking, which was quite extraordinary. And our neighbours on the other side was the man who became chief constable of Devon, Mr. Steer, and his wife lived with his son John in a, and their evacuee. Well, John and the evacuee and Mrs. Steer were still in the Anderson shelter, being buried and being dug out on the other side. And we viewed this with horror. But what was extraordinary was the, all that was standing was the bloody middle wall there. And yet the cabinet, which looks a bit like that glass-fronted one down there, with all my mother's best crockery, was still there. I cannot believe that that crockery survived. Well, of course it didn't. Even though they put a home guard on it with a bayonet later on, some bastard looter has got it. Mrs. Steer got out, and the children were safe. But it was a horrifying thing of just seeing the house gone.
How did that affect you? I mean, you were only a little kid.
Oh, it was amazing. I can't talk about it in psychological terms because you can't express it. It was just total shock. What's going to happen there? What is really, really the miracle was we would normally have gone into a shelter as Mr. and Mrs. Steer had done. My father had turned the duck pond at the back into a shelter by digging deep and putting breeze blocks. And if we had done that, we would have been killed because a landmine came, landed on it, and turned the roof up and dropped it on the bunks. So that was quite extraordinary. And then seeing the searchlights, of course, at night, you remember those being interlacing the sky and the barrage balloons. And then, of course, the people that came to visit us, which was quite a bit, the soldiers. Well, there was, wherever we were staying, some relative who had been in the army would come and stay with us when they were on leave. And there's one guy particularly who was my hero, you know, my Errol Flynn, he was a Gurkha officer, and he would always bring me hat badges and whatever it was the latest trophy. And I thought Harold was the best thing that ever happened. I met him a few years ago, an elderly gentleman, and he isn't an Errol Flynn. He's an Arthur Askey. He's small, with a Lancashire accent and a sense of humour. And he remembered me immediately, which is amazing. I'd seen him. Towards the end of the war, another guy that influenced me enormously was, dear me, the names are going. But he got a commission in the field at Dunkirk. And an amazing man. Eventually became, I believe, Deputy Lord Lieutenant of the County of Essex, so I was told. Frank Everingham. He, at the end of the war, towards the end of the war, when we were living in a council house in Exeter, the war was still just coming to its close, was obviously conducting some kind of exercise. And I remember waking up one morning to excited cries from children in the street, and I was still lying in bed, and I looked out, and there was four tanks outside my house, and a Bren gun carrier. And he'd come around to see us, and brought these bloody tanks. It's just kind of amazing. He was a smashing man.
And we've sort of drifted away from, I drifted away from you being rehoused. I mean, how were you rehoused?
After the Blitz, well, houses were requisitioned. Local authorities had the power to take over and put you into empty houses or to live with families. And we first went out to a village in Oakhampton, just outside Exeter, which was very primitive, and my mother was very upset because there was no running water, no toilet, no closet. You had to carry buckets from some particular source to get into the house. But I found it very useful and interesting because I learned how to net rabbits and use a shotgun. At that age, was not supposed to do those sort of things at all, but the country folk had a different attitude to things.
And how long were you at Oakhampton?
Not very long, but that was also the period when my father decided I should go to a private school. And I ended up at Mount Radford School, which is a fee-paying grammar-type school, an extraordinary local reputation, or more than local reputation.
Now, what was that school like? How old would you be then?
Well, I would have been 10, about that, maybe a few months younger. What did I think of the school? It was where I learnt to fight, because I didn't fit in with the normal run of pupils there. I spoke with a proper accent, like, and knew what Dempster was. They were all farmers' lads, maybe, but they all had a different sort of attitude to things. And I certainly learnt to fight there.
What was it like educationally?
Looking back at it and speaking of the professional education, is very good. The curriculum was comprehensive and well taught, well put forward, and taught as means of thinking rather than just as subject matter to be learned. I mean, that was required.
Were you a day boy?
Yes. That makes a difference.
Was it in Exeter?
In Exeter, yes. I carry with it memories of sound more than anything else. The sound of masters' voices in the morning reading the prayer book, or from the book of Gospels. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and that lovely rolling English speech that gives you a feeling that language is more than just words.
Did you do well educationally, in your studies?
Well, I was never sort of top of the class or anything like that, but I came round the middles and things like that. My father never had any faith in me whatsoever and took me away early, so I never did any examinations. We just got to the end where my schooling finished just as the O-level was coming in. Previous to that, we had the school certificate, where you had to have at least 7 subjects on one, fail one, and you don't get the certificate.
So how long were you there for? Until 14?
Yes, because he took me away early and started me on an apprenticeship.
Now, what about sport? Were you interested in sport?
Yes, I did a lot of cricket. I did a lot of football. Was captain of one of the football teams. Was an influential member of my house, would you believe it? And yes, it's good, sport.
It's mainly team games, then?
Well, we did a bit of boxing as well, of course. And kids would never, the parents wouldn't allow the kind of things happened in school today that happened then, but it was just taken for granted that in the morning you would assemble in the playground and you would be drilled. And that was regardless of weather. And I mean regardless. It could be pouring with rain, but you would be still drilled like soldiers on the playground.
Did they have an officer's training corps?
No, they didn't.
So it's just informal drilling?
It was carried out in a military fashion by an ex-sergeant major who demanded military standards. And as far as playing football or cricket was concerned, we had superb fields and superb room for that sort of thing, but no. There was a crude pavilion and one cold water tap. So if you've been playing out and the sheep had been grazing and you got on the bus on the way home, people moved away.
And what about any other, recreations or any hobbies at the time? Were you in the scouts or anything like that?
Yes, I was a life boy, would you believe it? Yes, yeah, it was one of those. Well, you learned all sorts of things in Christian gospels and...
Which church were they attached to?
That was the Church of England. Because I was a choir boy at St. Mena's Church some considerable time.
Did you enjoy it?
No, not really, no.
Now, what about music generally? I mean, were you involved when you were young? Or
no, I wasn't. No, that came much later. Probably through the starting with the choirs. And then I remember hearing Well, one of the great influences of my life was on the way home from school one day. Don't ask me when, because I cannot remember. I was still at Mount Radford. And I came up Queen Street of Exeter and saw there was all these people gathered outside the Civic Hall. And inquisitively, I wandered up and wondered what was going on and looked at some of them were penguins, you know. Never seen a dress suit before with a bow tie. This guy came up and talked to me and said, did I like music? And I said, well, I didn't really know much about it, but I was interested. And he ushered me into the hall and found me a seat right on the sideline. I think it was Hugh Weldon, because it was the Western Philharmonic Orchestra, and I had no idea what a symphony orchestra was. And I was entranced by the sound. And I know now that the lady that came on to play, whose name I'm rapidly trying to remember and I can't, a very famous virtuoso violinist of her day, had been booked to play the Beethoven Violin Concerto. I know this now. At the time I didn't. And the Beethoven Violin Concerto had a long introduction before the soloist enters. Whereas the other popular concerto of the day was the Mendelssohn E minor, had about a beat and a half and the soloist is in. And she was expecting the Beethoven. And suddenly there's this beat and a half and she's up and she's playing the Mendelssohn. She never missed a note. It was perfect. And I was entranced and moved by the whole process.
That was the start of your interest in music?
Oh, yes, I think so, yes. And then
classical, mainly, not jazz.
Very classical. I was probably still am a bore, as far as that sort of thing is concerned. So later, when I went in the army and was playing, I played a lot of some jazz stuff.
Well, come on, because I presume you learnt the instruments after the war. Do you remember the end of the war and the sort of V-Day, VJ?
Yes, I do. But we didn't take part in it. Oh, there was lots of street parties. Very, very jovial things.
Do you remember them? How were they organised? What was it typical? Well,
they were well laid out with tables in the centre of the street and traffic was stopped and people was around all day getting their drinks and their food, which was all laid out, and activities were arranged, dancing till 2 in the morning.
Were things organised for you kids? Or?
No, we all took part in everything the way it was. We joined in with the adults. But I remember for the first time, the E-Day, I think it was, walking up Exwick and then looking out over the city and had never seen the cathedral lit up before. Because that was the extraordinary thing about the bombing, was that the little Anglo-Saxon churches which surrounded the cathedral and the cathedral close weren't touched, but everything around them had been rooted out. And we used to, when I was travelling by bus, we'd get off at the stops and we'd play in the old bomb sites, which was very, very dangerous. But yes, we'd do that.
So, after the end of the war, you carried on as you were at the school.
Yes.
Until 1946.
Something like that, yes.
And what did you do when you left school?
Well, my father obviously didn't think I was going to get any examinations, so he was one of these men that did something and then told you you learned about it when he was doing it. And I got up early one morning, very, very early, dressed in overalls which I'd never seen before, taken in the car to a extraordinary dump for the GPO, which was a place where they stored all the telegraph poles and oscillating equipment, whatever, introduced to the foreman and told that I was my new apprenticeship. I was an apprenticed engineer from then on for the GPO. Didn't even know it was going to happen.
And what exactly were you learning as an apprentice?
To survive. Because it was very hard. We were learning about how telephones worked and had to climb telegraph poles and pull wires in. And I went to the school at Bristol where they taught you how to melt the lead around the casing of a telephone, all the wire cables that went. I was totally impractical. Didn't like it, didn't last all that long, and eventually ended up by becoming another apprentice with a spectacle firm, making glasses.
And when did you start that?
I think it was 1947. Now, I've always been very lucky because I've met interesting people who have been formative in my thinking and helping me on the way. And that apprenticeship was particularly interesting because of I should never forget the foreman, man Ronald Silman. A good man, a man that believed in education. And although I was learning how to make glasses and things like that and do it accurately and with care, which was insisted upon, he also wanted you to extend your knowledge. So you play games during your tea break based upon things like the Pears Encyclopedia and the knowledge that was in it. Question games, questions, anything which tests your ability to think. So it was a wonderful apprenticeship.
So you were learning to grind the lenses?
Oh yes, to shape them, make the frames, put the arms on, work out a prescription.
Now I've seen your thing, and it seems it's a very good reference you got for that one. So
did
you,
I?
You obviously settled to this one.
Oh yes, well the people were interesting, interested, caring for their work, and obviously liked people. Very important concepts there.
Now, while you were there, were you developing this interest you'd conceived?
Yes, I'd taken a strong interest in music from the time just before I left school. I was learning the violin, I was learning the clarinet, and I was learning about the theory of music as well. I was a member of various orchestras and took part in the cathedral choir and the cathedral orchestra.
You were pushing on a broad range of fronts there.
I mean, oh yes, I was. It was fascinating. But then again, I was lucky. You see, I met these interesting people. I walked into the market, and to the old bookstall there, and the guy that ran that was a musician, who was also the conductor of the Exeter Symphony Orchestra. And would I like to play? So I entered that lot.
Now, which was your main instrument? Was it a violin?
Violin. Yes.
And how good were you getting at that?
I was competent. I was never very brilliant.
You weren't orchestra standard then, if you see what I mean.
Yes and no. I was standard of that orchestra. Otherwise, he wouldn't let me play. I he buried me at the back of the second fiddle somewhere. But there was also a guy called Fowle, who was a train driver. And he was an absolutely brilliant cellist. And his wife was a poet. And so weekends I would spend playing quartets, chamber music, with them. Which was very unusual for a lad of my generation, I suppose.
Yeah. So you carried on working at the ophthalmic manufacturer, and yeah. You carried on the music collection until 1952?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.